Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
I will start by offering an explanation for why there wasn't an episode last week. We had a few inquiries. Why wasn't there an episode? Did you guys skip a week? Did you go on vacation? No, nothing so joyful.
We recorded an episode. There was
a great episode that you'll never hear because I forgot to turn on Melanie's microphone. Yep, that happens. I usually do a mic check ahead of time, you know, at the beginning, just to make sure the sounds are all good and all that. But I was rushing because it was late, and so I didn't do that. And of course, that meant I didn't turn on Melanie's microphone. So, So we're doing it again.
Yes.
Well, that gives me a chance to once again wish you a happy birthday, Melanie.
Woohoo! A week late.
it wasn't ever going to be like on the day. I mean, the day we recorded was early, so now we're later. So yes, this is the after your birthday. So how was your birthday, Melanie?
It was excellent. Thank you.
What did we do for your birthday? Refresh my memory. What did we do for food?
We had Jamaican takeout that I went and got.
Right.
It was good.
Yes. Tell the funny chicken. The funny bit about the patties.
Okay, so I love the Jamaican chicken curry patties. They're just like
patties are like a hot pocket.
Like a pasty
or
like a Cornish pasty.
Yeah.
Right. They're like dough, flaky pastry dough with meat.
Stuff inside.
It can be vegetables. It can be meat.
Every culture has a version. Calzone, dumplings, something like that.
Anyway, the Jamaican ones are really good.
They are really good.
Really, really good. And especially the chicken curry ones are my favorite. So when I went in, I asked if they had any chicken patties and they said, no, they didn't. Some guy had come in earlier in the day and had cleaned them out. Like he just took them all. And the woman was saying that it's kind of like they're a small little restaurant.
Little family business.
And it's kind of like that. Like some days one person comes in and takes all the patties. Other days nobody wants them at all and they end up throwing them out. And I said, wait, you throw out the chicken patties? I said, don't do that. Call me. Here's my number. And I will take the chicken patties off your hands.
We're literally down the street. I mean, it's right there. But yes, we will. We would take.
I literally gave them my phone number. She wrote it down. I am now the chicken patty lady at the Jamaican jerk place.
Everything jerk.
Yes. So, she laughed. She thought it was funny, but she did write down my name and number. So maybe someday I will actually get a call from them to tell me that there are extra chicken patties going wanting.
And someday the big leagues will call you up. It'll be your time.
My time to shine.
And Anthony loves the jerk chicken. He loves the Jamaican chicken.
Is it
the jerk chicken or just the fried chicken?
Oh, no. Anthony likes the jerk sauce. Yeah. He was pulling the jerk sauce out of the refrigerator and like making as if he was going to drink it.
That's me, boy.
The kids who don't like spicy, they really do love the fried chicken.
Yeah, they make really, a great plain fried chicken.
Good fried chicken.
Yeah. So. Yeah, really good. Yeah, it's fun. There's such a lot of different food there. We talked about everything jerk in an episode way back. You can go check it out. That's really nice. And so I'm glad we were able to do something for your birthday. We weren't able to go out because various reasons, whatever. But So anything else about your birthday? You got up. You had your presents.
Yes. I got some nice books of poetry. I got a really pretty lamp, solar powered lamp for the patio. Some really nice fountain pens.
Shark pens.
And Yeah, I made myself a carrot cake. Really good carrot cake. The secret is the bourbon, guys.
Yes.
Soak the currants in the bourbon. I also soaked, I toasted the pecans, and I soaked them in the bourbon with the currants.
I'm not sure every carrot cake recipe has, like, currants and pecans, but
well,
they usually have
raisins, but I substitute Zante currants because those are, like, 100 times better than raisins.
Yes, they are. Raisins should not be cooked in food, but Zante currants are better, and anything soaked in bourbon is acceptable.
Bourbon.
If you soaked pineapple in bourbon and put it on pizza, I'd probably eat it. Actually sounds really gross. Don't do that.
But bourbon. It's good.
Yes.
I had to go out and buy some bourbon for the carrot cake, but it was worth it.
You had to go buy the bourbon. But you got the generics, the cheap stuff. Jim Beam, I think.
Yeah.
She didn't use my good bourbon.
No, I was tempted, but
thank you for not using my good bourbon.
Okay. Anyway, it was good.
Well, and the best part is it makes so much carrot cake that there's now another carrot cake in the freezer.
Well, but the thing is that I have, I didn't actually have a carrot cake recipe. I had a carrot cake muffin recipe that I had adapted, and that's what I had written down. And so rather than actually checking the amounts, I was just like, my regular muffin recipe is a double batch of muffins.
Two dozen
muffins.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So I made 2 dozen muffins worth of batter and then poured it into 2 cake pans. And then when it came out, I realized that I probably could have.
Yeah, if you, that it would be
1 dozen,
4 tiers, basically.
Right.
It would be a wedding cake of a carrot
so,
cake.
So I cut one of the two cakes in half and frosted it. And then the other one's in the freezer so I can have more carrot cake later. This is a good thing.
It is never a bad thing to have a carrot cake in reserve. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And cream cheese frosting.
So a stick of butter, a block of cream cheese, and a little bit of heavy cream with some powdered sugar and vanilla.
Yep.
It's the best. It's super fluffy and light and not too heavy.
Not too sweet.
Yeah. I like making my own frosting because I can make it less sweet. Mine is a lot less sweet than a bakery frosting.
I think we agree that almost all bakery frostings are way too sweet.
Yeah.
Way too sweet. Kids don't mind the sweetness, but although our kids have kind of grown up without the super sweet frosting so that when they get it, they're like, it's too much, which is kind of funny.
Right. They don't actually prefer super sweet.
Speaking of sweets, one of the things we talked about last time that we are going to talk about again is on August 6th, which was a Friday. That is the feast of Blessed Solanus Casey, who is the Franciscan porter for a Franciscan monastery in Detroit many decades ago, who is now blessed on his way to saint. And there's a great story about Solanus Casey and ice cream.
Yes.
Why don't you relate that story again,
okay,
Melanie?
So the story goes, and this was told by one of the friars, that there was a young friar who was a novice who was having major dental pain. And he was going to the dentist and he knew that there was going to be a lot of work and he was afraid that it was going to put him out of commission for a while and that he'd have to go back and start his novitiate over again, as was the custom at that point, I guess, if you got too far behind. So he went to Father Casey and asked for his blessing. He already had a reputation.
Yeah.
And he gave the friar's blessing and he went off to the dentist. And while the friar was gone, a woman came in and handed
Father
Solanus two ice cream cones. And much to the consternation of the secretary, he stuck them in the drawer of his desk and she went on her merry way. And the secretary was convinced,
yeah,
well, as anyone would be, that it was going to be a big goopy mess that she was going to have to clean up, or he was going to have to clean up. I don't know. It didn't specify. But the friar came back at least half an hour after this from the dentist, and he had been miraculously cured. Like, his teeth were fine.
He got there and there was nothing to be done.
Yes. So he came back to thank Father Solanus and Father Solanus to celebrate.
That's great news. Here, have an ice cream cone.
He opens the drawer and he pulls out not two, 3 ice cream cones and hands them to the friar to celebrate his wonderful dental recovery.
His miraculous dental recovery.
Yes.
And so let's eat a bunch of sugar. So
I love it.
Yes.
Several friends had suggested that going and getting ice cream cones was the perfect way to celebrate
the feast of
Solanus, Casey.
Hey, I am all over that.
And we had been talking about like wanting to go out to your favorite ice cream place.
Yes, the best ice cream stand in America, in the world, according to not just me, but according to several magazines and websites.
I still think that Italian gelato is better, but it's pretty good.
Italian gelato was pretty darn good.
I had the
So the ice cream place is called Crescent Ridge Dairy in Sharon, yes, Massachusetts, and that's the place we went when I was a kid growing up. We would go there. My mom would take us there, and you would get our ice cream cones from the stand, and we sit on the roof, on the hood or the roof of the car, eating our ice cream under the summer sun, summer night sky. Actually, it was usually at night, and I have a massive, amazing memories having to do with that. But okay, so but you got?
I got the Cherry Ridge Ripple, which was one of the best. I have to say, it was one of the best ice creams I've had in a long time.
Yep.
Big chunks of cherry, lots and lots of fudge ripple.
I got Butter Crunch, which turns Melanie's stomach because it's basically butterscotch ice cream, yeah, and Melanie hates butterscotch. Who hates butterscotch? Does anybody else hate butterscotch? Because
I think it's gross.
You're the only person I've ever met who dislikes butterscotch. It's amazing.
I don't understand why anyone likes it. It's gross.
I love Butter Crunch. Although I would also equally love coffee ice cream. I stand coffee ice cream. So I got coffee, and then for the kids, who are uniformly in lockstep, was it Sophie and
everybody got mint chocolate chip except Lucy, who doesn't like mint chocolate chip.
Yes, she got chocolate. Yes.
And everyone was a glorious mess, yes, let me tell you.
And we all got kiddie cones, the kid size. It's kiddie, small, medium, and large. And kiddie cones are sufficient for any adult. I'm not sure I could eat a small, never mind a medium or large, fast enough that it wouldn't melt all over me.
And it's just too much ice cream.
It's like a pint of ice cream on a large.
Right. The kiddie cone was plenty. That's like more than I serve myself when I am serving ice cream.
Yes.
The small is a ridiculous amount where I feel sick having finished it. But of course, you don't throw away ice cream, so you eat the whole thing and then feel sick. Like, that's just ridiculous.
You get a large with a cone and a cup, and then you eat as much as you want, and you put it in the cup, and put a lid on it, and put it in the freezer, and that's
that would be fine.
They even have a tot size, which is even smaller than the kiddie cone. But yeah, the kiddie. I don't understand the economics of this. Why they like? I mean, maybe the markup is so high that
people want it.
Will order a small, and that, because they're like, oh, I don't really want a medium or a large. I'll order a small, and they'll pay. But it wasn't even all that expensive. I mean, for 7 ice cream cones, it was like under $25, which I don't know. Anytime I go out anywhere and buy something for all of us, I'm always expecting to be over like $30. Like, you can't get away with anything for under that much. So, I mean, $25, 7 cones, we're talking $3 each or something for a kiddie cone. I don't know. I don't understand the economics of it. All I know is it was really awesome ice cream and we had a really good time. It was a nice, I took the afternoon.
It was a nice outing.
Yeah, and we drove down there and then came back and had dinner afterward.
But nobody really wanted lunch dinner.
Nobody was all that hungry for dinner, but, you know, we ruined our dinner. But that's awesome. So I think that should be an annual tradition. We should celebrate Solanus Casey's feast day.
I am in favor of
by
that.
By going out for really good ice cream, and that's the key.
What's funny, because Father Solanus is also associated with another food story, which is not nearly so appetizing.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
So there was another young novice friar who had come sort of, I think, starry-eyed. Like, he'd heard stories of Father Solanus, and he entered the friary like wanting to be like this great holy friar who he'd heard so much about. So he, the first day, decides to follow Father Solanus around, watch him like eagle-eyed and do whatever he does. Just, I'm going to do whatever he does, and then that will be my path to sainthood and holiness. So Father Solanus had this custom of taking his breakfast cereal and pouring everything into the bowl. his coffee, his prune juice, his milk, his cereal.
Like everything he was eating for breakfast would go into one bowl.
Right. It's just one big bowl and eat it. And the famously, the novice says, if that's what holiness looks like, I don't want any of it.
That looks like a holy mess is what it is.
Yeah. I'm not sure if Father Solanus did it as penance because he really liked it or just because it was more efficient.
There are guys I know who, like the crotchety guys, who would say that's more efficient and they'd swear by it. But yeah, that is wild. So the only other thing to mention is, oh, and then this Sunday we had a scout event. So it was another Scout Sunday event. We had like a Catholic Scout Sunday event a few weeks ago, and then we had another one this one. So our Cub Scout pack is chartered through the local Episcopalian church. None of our Scout organizations are chartered in Catholic churches, which is kind of funny. But it's at the local Episcopalian place, and the priest there is leaving. He's moving on to something new. He's going to become a therapist or something, I think they said. And they were having a special Sunday service, a going away service, and a going away party afterward. And so they asked all the Scout families who could be there to go. And so I tend not to go to the religious events, the scouting religious events that aren't at Catholic masses. Part of it is because, especially in the last year or so, to get to Catholic mass, you have to go to a specific one. You know, it was very tricky. But also, they all tend to be at the time that mass is for us. And I'm not going to skip mass to go to the Episcopalian church or, you know, Congregational church, something like that, or Baptist church. You know, we have to go to mass. So, but this week I said, okay, we're going to make a special effort. So I got up with Lucy and Anthony. We went to the 7:30 a.m. mass. Let me tell you, those poor kids did not want to get out of bed when I woke them up. They were not happy.
Neither one of them is an early riser.
We have to get to the 7:30 mass, we have to leave the house like at 7:20. Anthony's in his pajamas, sits down at the table at 7:10 with a bowl of cereal. I'm like, dude, we need to go. And he's like, what? Yes, we need to go. He's like, okay, I'll eat quick. And he's like eating. It's like 7:15. I'm like, dude, you're done. Go get dressed. So, you know, we'll save the milk for your cereal tomorrow. So we went to mass at not our parish. It's the other parish that has the air conditioned parish where we have the very short mass for the summer because, you know, it's too hot to have a long mass in the air conditioned church. So we don't do the Gloria or the Creed or any music. I think I already talked about that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then afterward, you guys went to our regular parish at the regular time. So afterwards, I took Anthony and Lucy to this Episcopalian church. And boy, was that an experience. So they had a brass band for the music, trumpet, horns, you know, the whole thing. The opening hymn was As the Saints Go Marching In. The offertory was Stand By Me. And the communion hymn was The Circle of Life from Lion King. I'm not going to complain about the music at our mass anymore. What struck me, though, was how similar to the mass, to the prayers from the Catholic mass, the prayers of their service were. Like, in many cases, nearly word for word.
Yeah.
They have a Eucharistic prayer. They have, like, it is fascinating that how much there was. Oh, the processional included a long stick with a paper cutout of a dove and a long ribbon that one of the older scouts, Matt, got roped into, like walking down the aisle, waving it around and stuff. And that was kind of amusing. But yeah, that was very different. And it was interesting because the kids kept looking at me like, should we be saying these prayers? Should we be singing this? I'm like, my philosophy is anything that I could say at Matt, like anything that doesn't have me saying something that I don't believe or I'm not in communion with them, I'm okay with saying, you know, like the Our Father and other things like that. But if it's like, I'm not in communion with you, you know, you're a different denomination, I'm just, I'll respectfully stay silent in this case. and that's what I did. But it's a very interesting experience to go to an Episcopalian service. Let me tell you. Yeah. So we didn't stay for the food afterward because the poor kids were starving by that point. They'd eaten before 7:30. It was now after 11:30, and the food wasn't ready for them to serve. So I'm like, I'm just going to take them home and give them some
real food.
Some food. You give them some regular home food. But yeah. So that's what's been going on. You took the kids on a hike to World's End.
We did on Friday. We went to a very nice hike at World's End. It was kind of a hot day, but
yeah.
World's End is, it's actually two islands connected by a causeway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's out like into the harbor.
Right. You park in the parking lot, it's on land, you walk across a bridge and then to one island, and the further island is by causeway.
Yeah.
Did you go across the causeway again?
We did, but we didn't go very far on the second island. It was hot.
I've never crossed the causeway.
I know.
I wanted to go this time. I couldn't. We're waiting for the dishwasher repairman. That's a whole nother story. I don't want to talk about the dishwasher. The still broken dishwasher.
The limit of a dishwasher.
Anyway, but I'm glad you guys went. I always love walking through World's End. It's a conservation area. We mentioned before, but it always feels like the Shire to me, you know?
We saw a hawk being chased by a crow, which was pretty cool.
That is kind of awesome.
there's always great birds. We saw like a snowy egret and a great egret. Mm-hmm. And
there's big open fields, there's huge trees, old trees.
Yeah, some really old trees. For a while, it was being, somebody was trying to develop it as like a private estate. They planned to build a house.
70 years ago.
Yeah. A long time ago. And so there's a great variety of trees that were deliberately planted
along these dirt carriage roads.
They were supposed to be carriage roads.
Yeah.
And so big, beautiful oak trees and tulip trees and an interesting variety of like some rarer trees, too. It's really lovely.
Yeah. It's great. Beautiful. We get to go there because we belong to the Trustees of the Reservation, which is a private conservation group in Massachusetts that owns a bunch of these properties that they conserve. And if you're a member, you get access to all the different places. So it's really awesome. All right, let's move on to things we've been cooking and eating. Last time I'd mentioned the pulled pork that I made. And so I made it on the grill.
Last time being the episode that
the episode that was, that you'll never hear. So I will talk about it again. This was a really good pulled pork recipe that was super easy.
Super easy, barely an inconvenience.
Barely an inconvenience, but very yummy. Make it on the charcoal grill. You can also, there's instructions for a gas grill even too. So it's just a pork butt, 5 to 6 pounds. You salt it, wrap it up for 18 hours or so in the fridge. Then you put it on the grill with some wood chips.
You used hickory, right?
Yes, I used hickory. So
I love hickory.
It's a banked fire. So you put all of the coals on one side with the aluminum foil packet of the chips, or I use chunks, on top of that to make smoke. And then you put the pork butt in a disposable aluminum pan on the opposite side, so not directly over the heat. And then it cooks for two-something hours? 2.5 hours, I think it was. And then you take it off, wrap it in foil tightly, and put it in the oven at low for 3 hours. And yeah, it was
so good. Like there was no sauce or rub or anything. It was just,
I mean, we served it with sauce, but it didn't need
I ate a serving of sauce to try it with the sauce, but honestly, I actually preferred it with no sauce, just the porky goodness of the meat itself.
The hickory smoked meat. It was really good.
It was so good.
And it was super easy. I mean, it was really amazing. I bought another pork butt just to do it again because it was so great to do. One of the other things I wanted to mention about it was the shredding. The recipe calls for throwing it in the stand mixer and shredding it with the paddle. But as we've talked about, that just turns into mush.
I don't like the texture as much. I like bigger chunks.
Yeah. So shredding it with forks.
Yeah, I don't really like the pulled pork or pulled chicken when it's too mushy, when it's too
fine.
Fine.
Yeah.
I like chunks I can chew.
One of the funny things is that this recipe that I got it serves it on hoe cakes. It's like Tennessee pulled pork sandwiches served on hoe cakes, which are a kind of pancake. That's not as sweet as a pancake.
I thought it was like a corn cake.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think it's kind of, it looks like a pancake though. I got the picture here.
But it's corn, right?
But I think it's corn. Yeah, I don't have the recipe here. But yeah, served it with pickles on a sandwich. It was really so good. So that was the pulled pork. I mean, I might try it with a little, like, I might add some, like a rub of a little garlic and onion powder and paprika or something.
I think that would be gilding the lily.
I know. I can't leave well enough alone, though.
No.
Anyway, we talked about your carrot cake. Tonight, you made something new. We had some, it's eggplant season. Let's just be straight up here. It is eggplant season.
It's eggplant season, and, well, a couple nights ago, you made something that was Mexican-y. I can't remember what it was.
The shrimp cocktail, Mexican shrimp cocktail.
Right. And I had been looking up, I had the eggplants, and I was thinking, they were starting to get mushy, and I said, I need a Mexican eggplant recipe to go with this. I found one that I really wanted to try, but it, like, the first step was, like, simmer a sauce for half an hour, and then, like, put it on the eggplant, and then bake the eggplant, and it looked way too complicated.
This was a Sunday afternoon recipe, not a Friday at 5.
Right. So it looked way too complicated, so I stuck the eggplant in the refrigerator and crossed my fingers and hoped that they would last a couple more days until I had time to do this. It was worth it. So this was like a chipotle and adobo sauce. So you started off with chipotle and adobo, and you added brown sugar, molasses, balsamic vinegar. It's like somebody said, let's put all the darkest things in the cabinet into the sauce.
The heart of Sauron.
Right. And then you reduce it down for half an hour, and then you add some soy sauce.
Mm-hmm. So
it is dark.
Chipotle and adobo. Chipotle are smoked jalapenos. Adobo is a thick sauce that they come in a can. And it's magic in a can.
It is.
It makes everything taste better.
Super smoky, really rich, and spicy. Very spicy.
And tons of umami. You know what I mean? It's got that, yeah. Boom. You put it in soups and stews. It's awesome. Anyway.
So this was like a very sweet, spicy sauce. So then what you did is you cut your eggplant into rounds and you brushed it with oil. I salted it and then patted it dry, of course, because that's what one does with eggplant. But then you brush it with olive oil and then you brush this sauce onto it. And then you stick it in the oven at 425 to cook, flipping it occasionally. Then, meanwhile, you take a can of black beans and you pulverize it. It said in the blender. I think that makes too much of a mess, so I just use my immersion blender in the pot. And so you make the beans into, like, a paste. And you use the liquid that's in the can as well.
Yeah.
So it's... It's like a creamy sort of paste. Then you cook that down with some more of that spicy...
The rest of that
black sauce.
Yeah.
It was called like a salsa negro, I think it was. Like, mm-hmm. Black sauce, literally. You cook it down a little bit. Not a lot, but just like to warm it up, really. And then when the eggplant comes out of the oven, you serve it. You're supposed to serve it with like... The fancy plate suggestion was like put the black bean salsa down and then put the eggplant on top and then sprinkle it with queso fresca, fresh cheese, and then some Mexican crema. I didn't have the queso fresca, but I did have some sour cream, so yeah. I just used that and some chopped cilantro. I didn't do fancy plating because it was just Dom and I eating
us.
It.
Yeah.
And, but I thought it looked really pretty. Like, I put the eggplant on my plate and then I poured the black bean sauce on it. And then I put a dollop of sour cream and I sprinkled it all with cilantro. It looked really pretty. It looked like restaurant worthy.
Yeah. It was so good.
This was like,
the sauce had a depth of flavor. I mean, you had so many like bam, bam, super flavor things in there. I mean, you've got the vinegar, the balsamic, you've got the soy, you've got the chipotle and adobo. I mean,
molasses.
I mean, you've really hammered in all of these flavor packed things.
But then you cook it. When you cook it, it kind of mellows those flavors.
Right.
And the soy added like that layer of salty umami.
Yes.
And
then the black beans kind of, they, they make it creamier and they kind of take the edge off.
Right. And I was thinking, like, this could be easily a vegetarian meal, like a meat-free meal, because the black beans are pretty substantial and the eggplant is pretty...
A Friday or Lenten meal or something
Right,
like
pretty
that, yeah.
substantial too. And then when you, if you, especially if you had the cheese, which we didn't have, but like cheese and sour cream, like, so you've got your dairy, you've got your beans, you've got your vegetable.
Right. You got a protein, you got dairy, you got, it's actually a fairly complete meal. And yeah, the sauce, again, I mean, it was like a mole.
The sauce was awesome.
It reminded me a lot of a mole. I mean, if you added a little, like something chocolate in that.
You could do that.
That might be. That would not be gilding the lily. That might actually.
A little dark chocolate might actually be good. Yeah. Not a lot.
Not a lot. No, no, no. You don't want it to be a sweet thing, but like just enough to give it that oomph. The dark chocolate.
Although, oomph. I don't know. It was almost perfect the way it was. It was really good.
Why mess with perfection?
Right.
All right. Yeah. So that's really good. And that is definitely going on our list. In fact, you have not put it in the paprika recipe app.
I did.
I have not seen it yet. So
it's in there.
It's in there. It's like Prego.
Yeah, I think this is like a Washington Post.
Yeah. Spicy chipotle eggplant with black beans. If you have a link, Melanie, maybe we should find the link for that and put it in the show notes.
I should.
People are going to want to know. All right. Let's move on. We have an extensive list of things we've been reading or watching because I have dropped a few of the things that I mentioned last time just because they weren't worthy of mentioning again. But I do want to talk about one thing I've watched was there's a series on Netflix called The Movies That Made Us.
And right. You've talked about that before.
Yes. The first season had things like Home Alone and Dirty Dancing. And I don't remember the other ones. The second season just dropped and I watched the first episode of that one, Back to the Future. And it was really good. Everyone knows that Eric Stoltz was supposed to be the lead character. He was supposed to play Marty McFly. And they actually filmed like a week's worth of the movie before they replaced him. And it's always been like, well, why did they replace him? Why did they bring in Michael J. Fox instead? They always wanted Michael J. Fox.
Right.
But they couldn't get him because he was in Family Ties, which was one of the biggest shows at the time. And they couldn't get his schedule, didn't allow him to be in it. So they went with this other guy, Eric Stoltz. And the problem with Eric Stoltz is he just treated it like it was a serious role. It was not a comedy for him. He kept playing it straight. And they're like, it's not a straight. He's like, but this is horrific. This man who goes back in time, this boy, and meets his parents and, you know, and he has to save his life by make sure they get together. And it's like, dude, it is not that kind of movie.
Right.
And so they ended up canning him and going to the producer of Family Ties and getting his permission to allow Michael J. Fox to do it. And Michael J. Fox jumped at it because he hadn't had a movie career yet. This was his big move. And he ended up filming Family Ties during the day and hopping in a limo and driving over to the other lot and filming Back to the Future at night. And if you look at it, a lot of Back to the Future takes place at night.
A lot of it does take place at night. Yeah. Like the parking lot scene and when the
Twin Pines Mall.
Right.
Yes,
the clock tower, the dance.
Yeah. I mean, the dance is the same night as the clock tower. Like, yeah, a lot of it takes place at night. So it wasn't
originally written to be like all at night?
I don't know. But I think they arranged the way they filmed it. So that was either outside at night or the early stuff was either outside at night or indoors on a soundstage.
Right.
So it was one or the other. The other thing that was interesting about that they mentioned, Crispin Glover, who played his dad, McFly, is a weird dude. Like they were talking about how they would be in the scene and you have a mark, like an actor has a mark, literally a mark on the ground that they're supposed to stand on. This is where you stand to make sure you're properly in the camera shot.
Right.
Because in movies, the camera doesn't really move all that often. You know, it's actually very static if you pay attention. But he kept wandering off his mark and wandering out of the camera. And they're like, Crispin, where are you going? Like, but my character wants to go over there. Like, he's actually apparently a lot like the character of McFly. So just very, it was very funny. There's a lot of stuff like this. Talks about how Robert Zemeckis, the two Bobs. So Robert Zemeckis was the director, and Bob, this other guy, Bob, who was his writing, movie-making partner from college. They'd known each other. They were the two Bobs. Had a string of failures before making Back to the Future. And Spielberg came along, and they wrote a movie for him called 1941 after Jaws. It was a failure. It was Spielberg's first flop. Still gave them a chance. And this was their big break. This was what made Robert Zemeckis the big star director that he eventually became. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun series. If you have Netflix, check it out, especially if you're anywhere near our age, you know, the 40s and 50s. It's a lot of these movies from when we were young. The Pretty Woman, I think, is the next one in line after Back to the Future. They have Gremlins, I think. And I never saw Gremlins. I'm not a horror movie. The Gremlins kind of creeped me out, so I never watched it when I was a kid. So
they creeped me out when I was a kid, too.
Yeah. All right. So that's the movies that made us. It's the season two. I watched Fate of the Furious.
Oh my God.
So that was the eighth movie. Fate, get it? Fate of the Furious. It's a pun.
There's
on eight.
A pun on eight. Yeah. Oh my, that's really bad.
F9 is the one that just came out this summer. And I was remarking to someone, like, it is amazing how far from its origins this movie series has gone. Like, the first movie was about, like, an undercover cop, you know, going undercover with the criminal underground street racers in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. I mean, it was very kind of straightforward, pretty grounded.
So what is it now? I haven't
now,
seen any of those.
They are like, they go out, they are recruited by a shadowy government agency to go after supervillains who fly around the world in stealth jets who are trying to end the world with nuclear weapons.
What?
Yes. And the physics in these movies, like, come on, like, Vin Diesel's driving this car backwards at like 80 miles an hour. The engine is glowing red hot because that could happen. And he has to dive out of the car before it crashes through a seawall into the ocean in Havana. That's because he's racing in Havana for some reason. And, you know, rolls, gets up, dusts himself off, and he's okay. No, not that physics doesn't work in this world.
Okay, then.
It was, I mean, you don't watch this for reality, for drama. This is all popcorn, action movie. Look at the fast cars.
That's so
and the
not,
crazy action and the silly comedic elements.
That's so not my genre.
It is so not your genre. There is no depth at all in these movies. Superhero movies, like the Marvel movies. There's at least something to chew on there.
I need something to chew on.
This is purely popcorn. Check your brain at the door. Have a little fun sort of movie. I mean, I would never pay to go to the theater to watch this. So, although apparently I bought the Fate of the Furious and all of the previous movies at some point in some bundle that iTunes offered. It was like $20 to get them all. I'm like, okay, it's like eight movies. I'm sure it's like $2 each.
Sometimes I wonder. Yeah. I wouldn't pay that any money for them.
I was going to watch it at some point. I wanted to watch the movies, so I figured, you know, why not?
Okay. Anyway,
so that one. So another one. So I recently had to resubscribe to Paramount Plus because the new Star Trek Lower Decks season is starting, and I'm going to have to talk about that for Secrets of Star Trek. And I only subscribe to Paramount Plus when I'm talking about a new Star Trek series.
Okay.
So I was noodling around in the listings, and I saw this Paramount original movie called Infinite, starring Mark Wahlberg.
Infinite. Like endless.
Yes. Infinite.
Infinite bad?
Infinite good? Was it infinitely bad? It was not infinitely bad. It was not infinitely good. It was not really even all that good.
Okay.
So the premise is reincarnation, that people are reincarnated when they die, and there's 500 people for whom they remember everything from their previous incarnations.
500 in the whole history of the world?
Yes, that they're all alive now. Like they're essentially immortal or infinite in the sense of when they die in one life, when they hit puberty in the next life, their memories come back and they remember everything from all of their previous lives.
You know, this sounds like a
including
dream.
Including all their skills.
This sounds like a dream that my sister once told me about that was like a recurring dream that she had that she kept going back to.
Maybe so she wrote about it online and someone made it into Mark Wahlberg made it into a movie.
That could be.
So but these reincarnated infinites have divided into two groups. The believers, which are the good ones who want to use this power and ability to improve humanity, and the nihilists who just want to die. And the only way to die would be to destroy all the humans on Earth and all life on Earth so that they cannot be reincarnated into anything. And so,
what's the good that you can do by remembering your past lives? Like, how does that work as like a force for good?
Yeah, that's a good question. No one really. I mean, I suppose say you were a scientist and you were studying this thing and you only have your whole, you know, your life, and then you die. You can't continue. But what if you had 5,000 years to study something?
But do they have examples of people doing that, like 5,000-year-old scientists who are...
I mean, there's people who really know a lot, and they're really good at martial arts.
Uh-huh.
This, again, not a great movie. There was a lot of potential in this movie that got wasted on scenes of them, like, driving through police stations and blowing things up creatively. And
so basically it was kind of like one of the Highlander movies?
It's basically Highlander, yeah. So at one point, Mark Wahlberg jumps a motorcycle off a cliff in Scotland and lands on top of a C-17, it was like a C-5 or something like that. It was a military jet, C-141, on the wings. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and because he's got to stop the bad guy who's inside with the doomsday device.
Again, another movie I'm not sad to have missed.
Yes, this is not a movie. Yeah, I mean, it's Mark Wahlberg being Mark Wahlberg, which is funny. You know, he's always entertaining. But there was a lot of potential in this movie that they just totally missed. Like his character, for some reason, did not come back with the knowledge that he needed. There was some sort of block that he thought was mental illness, and had been treating as a psychosis, et cetera, et cetera. But so he had this knowledge that he'd carried over of where he had stolen the doomsday device from the bad guys and hid it. But then died before he could tell anyone where he hid it. And so now everybody's looking for the doomsday device and looking for him to find out where the doomsday device is.
But they don't know who he's reincarnated as.
Until he starts doing stuff that reveals him. He gets arrested for using a samurai sword that he forged himself,
right,
to it kills a drug dealer, and the sword, because he used to be a master swordsmith in Japan, because people who are reincarnated in movies are never like reincarnated from like Joe Schmo nobody. They're always like, I used to be Napoleon.
I was an Egyptian princess.
Yes. No, you weren't like the Egyptian nobody, like down, you know, making mud bricks down by the waterside. No, no, no. You were always a princess or somebody important. Anyway, so it was amusing for an hour and a half or so. I mean, and it was short. It was a short movie. If they'd spent more time on it, they could have done something with it. Yeah. The only other thing I want to mention was the book I finished reading called The Indispensables by Patrick O'Donnell. It's a history of the Marblehead Regiment in the Revolutionary War. Now, you and I, Melanie, lived in Salem. That's where we met and we're married. And Salem is right next to Marblehead and are very historic places. Marblehead is known as the birthplace of the American Navy. And that's partly because the Marblehead Regiment were all of these Marblehead fishermen and sailors of various kinds who formed one of the early militias and were super good at their job. And in fact, they were indispensable. They were responsible.
Hence
the title of the book. They were Washington's first Navy, even before the Continental Congress provisionally created the Continental Navy. Washington had already commissioned some of these Marbleheaders to become privateers and to attack British shipping heading toward Boston, which was blockaded at the time. Then, but they were vital in several instances. They were the ones who managed the crossing of the Delaware, the famous crossing of the Delaware.
Right.
They're the guys who got them across in a blizzard. Like amazing. Losing nobody.
I suppose if you're a Marblehead fisherman, you're used to bad conditions.
Yes, exactly. But even more amazing to me was the one where the evacuation from Brooklyn Heights. So the when they were holding New York City against the British, and the British invaded via Long Island, and Washington met them across the East River in Brooklyn.
Right.
And they were surrounded and they were getting their butt kicked. The Americans, we were getting our butts kicked.
I remember this from Hamilton.
Yes.
Like it comes in.
Yes. Gibbs Bay. And which was a different battle, actually. But they're being pushed back. And they got to the point where they had to evacuate. So they gathered up all the boats they could, rowboats, sailboats, whatever, and waited for the dark of night. And they started pulling troops off the line with trying not to alert the British that they were doing so, sending their all the cannon, all the horses, all the supplies. At one point, the wind shifted and they couldn't use the sailboats anymore because it was going to start sending them down into the British ships. Oops. Half the British Navy was down river. As dawn came, they were worried because they hadn't got everybody across yet. And then the thickest fog anyone had ever seen rolled up miraculously. And so they kept going. They got everybody out, everyone, except for the last boat that left shore were three guys who were looting whatever remained. And they got caught by the British who showed up like, well, where is everybody?
So that was their own stupidity.
That was their own stupidity. But everybody, they got everybody. It was to this day, it's one of the most successful amphibious operations in history. It was bigger than Dunkirk. But that was the Marbleheaders. They managed that. So really interesting book. There were aspects of the book weren't so great. Each chapter kind of felt like it was a new essay. Like sometimes the author repeated things that he said in previous chapters. He liked to list the members of the regiment at certain times.
Hmm, so maybe they were written as a series of articles then collected in a book. Or
it kind of felt that way. One of the really cool things about the regiment is that it was the first and for hundreds of years after that time, only integrated a military regiment in the American military. They had freed Black Americans. They had Native Americans. They had Hispanic members and Europeans, white guys, all together in the regiment. Together. It was unique.
Which makes sense because sailing ships at that time were...
Exactly.
Were integrated much more than any other walk of life.
Right, right, exactly, and that's why it was. It's an interesting book. I mean, it's not the best colonial history. I could recommend some others about the War of Independence, but for the area that it covered of these guys from Marblehead, it was really good, and it really shined a light on some guys who needed to get more attention.
Sounds like it needs to be a movie.
It needs. I always say this. There is exactly one Revolutionary War movie. One, The Patriot.
I suppose you could count like 1776.
It
was really
well. That's
musical.
Not a movie though. It's like a musical. Wasn't it a miniseries?
No, it was a musical.
It was a musical. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's. I will bend and say two. There were two. Like there needs to be movies. Like I've read some of these books. Like it was recently on Bunker Hill. I'm like, this is an amazing story. It needs to be a movie. So someone needs to get out there and do this. I heard Matt Damon had bought the rights to one of these books and the film rights.
Well, if anybody.
Get on it, Matt.
Yeah. Come on, Matt. You owe Boston some.
Yes, you know. You owe us. Because, you know, all of the stuff you've already done, it was not enough.
No.
So tell me about what you've read and watched.
Okay. So last week. I mean, last like Monday, I guess. I finished The Glass Palace by Amitav Ghosh, which was awesome. So basically,
this is another
it's
book
a historical
from that
novel.
Indian author that you were talking
right.
about before. Yeah,
right. He's an Indian author who spends part of his time in New York. So he's sort of bi-country, bilingual, probably trier, quadrilingual, who knows?
Yep.
Evidently, one of his grandparents, I think, was Burmese. And this novel centers around Burma. The glass palace of the title is the palace of the king of Burma, the last king of Burma, who the novel opens like in the first like chapter or two, the British march in and take over Burma. And the king and his entire family and household are moved to India so that a revolution can't form around him. So it's sort of a benign, like, we're not going to kill you, but we're going
thanks to, for the favor.
But we're going to put you in exile in a city in India in this like rundown crummy house with a household. So the main point of view character is a young boy who's Indian. He's Bengali, and he's an orphan. His parents have both died. They were on a boat, like sailing between India and Burma. And so his mom dies. He's left in Burma, and he decides to stay. When the British come in and the king is taken, looters go into the palace, and so he accompanies the looters into the palace, and he finds himself suddenly face to face with the queen, who is kind of the power behind the throne. Like, the king is kind of nobody. The queen's really the political mover and shaker who got him onto the throne and then killed off all of his siblings, like 40 or 50 of them, to make sure that their line of succession was secure. So
ruthless.
She's ruthless. So then this young boy meets this young girl who is one of the queen's maidservants. She's also an orphan who the queen has surrounded herself with these like orphan girls to be her personal servants who will be intensely loyal to her. And he's kind of fascinated by this girl. And so years later, after he's made his fortune in the teak industry,
teak wood, which is very important.
Harvesting and selling teak. He goes to India and finds her and, well, marries her. And so then they have this family. So he's Indian, but has been living in Burma for years and years and years. And she's Burmese, but has been living in India, and they end up marrying. And so then the story kind of centers around them and their kids, and then later their grandchild. But then also, while they're in India, while she's in India in exile, she meets the local colonial official for the British government is an Indian who has been educated in Cambridge. And so she becomes best friends with his wife, and he ends up dying. But the wife and her nieces and nephews also sort of intermarry with the children of the main characters. And then there's another branch of distant relatives in Malaysia. So the novel kind of takes place in Malaysia, Burma, and India, and it's over the course of like 100 years. I think it starts off in like 1880, and it ends in 1996.
Wow.
A lot of it takes place during World War II. World War I is almost glossed over. There's not a whole lot of action in the Pacific in World War I. But World War II, several of the main characters are in Burma and Malaysia when the Japanese invade and get caught up in the war. There's also a character who becomes he's an Indian soldier, like in the British Army, who ends up deserting and becoming a freedom fighter. There's a huge thread of theme about independence from colonialism and activism against the British government. It's very interesting, like this idea of like divided loyalties. Who do you have loyalty to? And just a part of the world I know very little about: Burma, Malaysia, India, and certainly not from the point of view of the locals.
Yeah, the natives.
So there are, you know, people go to abroad to the United States and to India. One of the characters, into
England.
Yeah. One of the characters ends up marrying a British girl and brings her back to Malaysia. And so there's these threads of like international travel, but really the center of the book is between Burma.
Yeah.
And really I keep coming back to Burma, and which has been really in the news a lot recently. Now I feel like I have a much better understanding of what's going on, because this pretty much covered Burmese history from
the British
invasion to the present.
Right.
And why it's such a huge mess.
Huh.
Basically the British mess.
Wow.
The author's point of view is not terribly favorable to Britain and to colonialism in general. He's pretty much like colonialism.
Understandable.
Right. And so that's really interesting to have a character who is Indian, who is critiquing the colonialism from the point of view of. But in English. So there's this sort of weird sensibility where he's writing in English, which is the language of
the empire, colonizers.
Right. Yeah. To critique the whole project. And it's just a beautiful novel. There's so many different interesting characters, and the Glass Palace becomes this really great metaphor for the Burmese underground, because one of the characters is a photographer and he opens a photography studio called the Glass Palace. So then the photographic lenses and things become sort of this metaphor for looking at the world from a different perspective, which is
Yeah,
it really worked very well.
Cool.
And so that's pretty much, I've been reading a few other things. I got books of poetry.
Yeah.
Then what I've been watching is a lot more Clone Wars, plus a few more episodes of The Bad Batch.
Right.
And also I started watching The Mysterious Benedict Society, because I know the kids have all read the books and I wanted to kind of.
And that's on Disney Plus.
It's on Disney Plus too. I wanted to preview the series. I didn't really have any real questions about whether it'd be suitable. I just kind of wanted to watch it so I knew what was going on, and then maybe I could tell them to go ahead and watch it. So we watched the first, I watched the first three episodes, and then with the kids today, I watched the first episode with them, and they loved it.
I noticed Lucy going right after we were done, going right back to the books.
She did. She had just finished reading the series, which is why I thought I was kind of holding off until she'd read the series before, suggesting that they watch the show.
It was good. I liked it. It was it kind of felt a little bit like Umbrella Academy, but younger.
And
lighter, not as dark.
Right.
But it had the quirky personality of Umbrella Academy.
Yeah, it's very quirky, and I really like the aesthetic sense of the show. There's a very sort of 1960s vibe.
Which is very popular now. Between the Loki episode, Umbrella Academy, there's this sort of paleo futurism in it.
And it's very bright. There's a lot of really bright colors that work well.
Yeah. A lot of primary color.
Yeah. But also lots of like pinks and pastels too. Like it's an interesting palette, because there's primary colors, but then there's also.
Right. They use color a lot for the story. Like the orphanage in the beginning, all the kids are in brown. They're like shades of brown.
Right.
And everything at the orphanage is brown except for the teacher. The one who comes in
She's in beautiful like teal and pink pastels.
Right. And she's the one who pulls this one boy out of the orphanage to something greater.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, the Mysterious Benedict Society is yet another story of exceptionally brilliant kids saving the world.
It's Harry Potter again.
Right. And yet there's something about it, which is not a trope that I'm terribly fond of. And yet there's something really charming about the way the Mysterious Benedict Society tells the story. The characters are interesting. I like them. I want to root for them. The actual plotting is kind of predictable, but it's kind of quirky in the way it hits the notes.
Yeah. I mean, if this were a Pixar animated movie, it would fall right in line. I mean, it's like, oh yeah, that's how it works. That's how a Pixar animated. It's like a live action version of an animation, really.
Right. It does kind of feel like it could be an animated movie.
Right.
Except with really cute kids.
Kids are cute.
I love all the actors.
Well, especially the Miss Contraire.
Yes.
Constance.
They do change her age. In the book, she's supposed to be two. She's supposed to be this brilliant two-year-old.
Oh, my gosh.
There's no way you could get a child that young to play the role. Because she's a two-year-old with an exceptional vocabulary, and she's brilliant, so she thinks like an adult, but she is a two-year-old. And with two-year-old's emotions. Like, you could do it in an animated movie, but they wanted to go live action, and I think that was a good call. So they just...
Yeah.
She looks like she's maybe 6 or 7.
She's younger than the other ones, definitely.
She's definitely younger, and they try to dress her up in a very young presenting way. But I think it works.
Yeah.
It works really well.
Yeah.
that they just, they do kind of skip over the fact that she's supposed to be two.
Was there another book that you mentioned? The Rhiannon Giddens book?
Oh, yeah. That was really excellent. It's an audiobook made for, it's an Audible original. And it's very short. It's like an hour and change. So it's not a really long book, but it's a memoir. Rhiannon Giddens is a great musician. And this is basically her musical memoir, her telling the story of her life in music and with punctuated, of course, with actual music and with some of her songs. So it kind of revolves around some key musical moments in her life. But she was classically trained in opera, although she had no formal music training until she went to university for music. She like was literally did not know how to read music and was like struggling with every good boy deserves favor.
The musical scale,
the basic scale. So she fully trained opera singer, and then kind of decided that she didn't actually want to live that lifestyle. Instead, her life took a weird left turn, and she went into old-time African-American music. She picked up the banjo, and she started looking at the roots of, like, the banjo was originally an African instrument. And so she formed a band called the Carolina Chocolate Dropses, which is where I encountered her first. The Carolina Chocolate Drops was a great band. They played old-time music.
Right, a lot of Carolina style, that low country music.
Right, it's beautiful, beautiful music. I highly recommend you check out Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's since left the group and gone on in her own direction. A lot. She's a singer, a songwriter as well as a singer. And she moved to Ireland. She's biracial. Her mother is black, and her father has Irish ancestry. They met and married like within a couple of years of the Supreme Court decision.
The Loving decision.
Yeah. So she's really kind of exploring now sort of the title of the book was
To Balance on Bridges.
So it's really about sort of all of the different bridges in her life and this act of balancing the different parts of her, like, she doesn't see them as in conflict, but is it like
just different threads?
Different threads, but they're often framed as being in conflict. Like, we want to say, "Are you black or are you white?" And she's like,
"Yes,
yes." So her current work, her last couple of albums, have been recorded in Ireland with this collaborator who is
Italian,
yeah. Francesco Teresi, who's an Italian musician who plays drums. Like traditional drums, and he's kind of very into reclaiming roots music in Europe, European music. So together they're sort of exploring American music, European music, roots of music, and it's just a really great story, beautiful music. Rhiannon Giddens is really a great musical educator as well as a great musician. I loved the audiobook.
Awesome.
Which should have been longer.
Yeah. All right, so that's what we've been a lot of reading and watching over the past 2 weeks. It's actually more, but nothing that was worth talking about, so we'll just move on from there, and we'll have more next time. Let us talk about, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about the gospel readings this week, and I actually didn't pull it up. I don't want to have it open on my computer, because whenever I have the browser open on my computer while we're recording, it slows things down drastically. So instead, I will use my phone.
Well, I want to say that the reading that really struck me was not so much the gospel as the first reading about Elijah.
Uh-huh.
This is one of my favorites because Elijah's really cranky. He tells God he wants to die. He's frustrated. He's in despair.
I just want to die now. Can I just die now?
Right. And what happens, though, is he ends up taking a nap and then God feeds him.
Sometimes he just.
And then he takes another nap and then God feeds him, and then he takes another nap and then God feeds him, and then he's fine and he's good to go. I love that
Sometimes you just need a nap and need, something to eat.
Right. And actually, Thomas Aquinas kind of references this, like, the you need a nap thing. And it's kind of lovely, just the idea that when you're despairing, when you're sorrowful, when your life's got you down, that caring for the body, like eating, look, bathing,
have something to eat,
like take a bath, take a nap, have some food. These Thomas Aquinas actually suggests that baths and naps are very good for treating sorrow. Because yeah. There is this mind-body connection, and I think that we have a tendency to either overplay self-care or to say...
Or over-spiritualize things.
Or over-spiritualize things, but also to, like, self-care has become almost a self-parody of itself.
Right.
But there is a root of, like, taking care of your physical needs really helps to deal with some of those spiritual... Sometimes it's not really depression. Sometimes it's spiritual anxiety and spiritual despair do have those physical elements where
maybe it's low blood sugar.
right. Sometimes you just need a nap.
I like the reading because it's like it's a very parent reading. Like parents can really identify. It's like it's like getting your kids up for mass. You have to wake them up twice.
Right.
Look, just get up and get something to eat here. Just get up here. Eat something. Come on. Let's go. Get into mass.
Right. I mean, it's very tender. It's like God is the very tender father taking care of Elijah as the child and just parenting him through this difficult moment.
I wonder if this is where the TV series Touched by an Angel gets its name, because it specifically says the angel came and touched him.
Hmm.
It also says that after eating, he walked 40 days and 40 nights.
Right.
That's some Lembas bread you got there.
Well, yeah, another,
which is why this reading is here. It's connected to the gospel, right, which is about the Eucharist.
Right. And another instance of the 40 days and 40 nights. It's such a great numerical significator.
I mean, either he walked really slow or he went really far walking 40 days and 40 nights.
Given the fact that he wasn't eating, maybe he didn't actually walk all that far.
Right.
Maybe he was walking in circles.
So at the mass we went to, Father had a homily, and he focused on the line where in the gospel where Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draw him." And Father said, "Well, let's rephrase that in the positive."
Right.
Everyone who comes to Jesus was invited by the Father first. And it's interesting. And he says, we like to think we invite God into our hearts. Oh, Jesus, enter into my heart. I'm inviting you to come. And it's like, no. I mean, that's good. But God invites us into his heart. God is the one who invited us into his heart.
Right. That reminds me of the beautiful book that I've been reading for years and years, just little snippets at a time, called God in Search of Man. And it's a Jewish philosophy of religion by Rabbi Herschel. And I love it because the whole premise of the book is that as much as we are in search of God, that's our response to God coming in search of us. God initiates. He is always the one looking for us. He's seeking the lost sheep. He's the bridegroom searching for his bride. No matter how much we turn away, he's always coming and looking for us.
Mm.
I love that.
Yeah, I really like that imagery, that idea that sometimes it feels like I have to do all the work. You know, like in my own head, I'm like, all right, I gotta be better. I gotta be a better Jesus. I gotta be the right kind of Christian for you to love me. You know, for me to be here. And it's like, no, I'm inviting you first. No. I do the work. Like, you have to repent and believe, but I've invited you. Like, I opened the door. Like, I'm the one who stepped through first. Come on. That was a really eye-opening or heart-opening moment in that homily. That really struck me. The other thing that struck me is, as the deacon read the gospel, he read the line, "Your ancestors ate the manna in the desert, but they died." I'm like, that is peak Boston. He had a wicked accent. They ate the manna in the desert. I posted it online and I called out Father Chip on that one.
Does Father Chip do the adding the extra R's?
I don't know, but I told him, just like, Father Chief, this is a Boston Priest thing and you can't deny it. He's like, whatever. Uh-huh. So.
Because that's not a universal Boston accent. That's like a very specific.
No, well, sort of. It's the that thick Boston accent is, you find it mainly among more blue collar or older folks.
Right.
Younger people have started to shed that, especially because in like a lot of accents, as people have, they watch more TV and listen to more radio and have traveled about and gone to school in different places. I have much less of a Boston accent than, like, say, my brother.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I occasionally drop the R's and that sort of thing, but much less so.
And I have a less Texan accent than my brother.
You have no Texan accent compared to your brother.
Compared to my brother, yes. When I've been on the phone with my brother, though.
Oh, yeah.
I start twanging. I do.
You twang all over the place.
When we went to Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yes.
My accent comes out a lot thicker. It does. Just plop me into Texas and I will sound like a native. I chameleon, and I don't do a Texas accent when I'm in Massachusetts, really.
Right.
Or at least when I'm not talking to someone from the South, except for the fact that when I'm talking to the kids, I will totally do the y'all. Like, come on, y'all, it's time to go.
Y'all is a useful word. The second person plural. It is useful.
But when I y'all, I say it like a Southerner. I don't say it like a Northerner putting on the y'all.
Mm. And our kids have New York accents, so who knew? I'm not sure why, but they do.
It's somewhere between Texas and Boston.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Do you have any water? Where did you come from? Anyway, but the gospel continues to be about the Eucharist, and it's a beautiful gospel. I really like it. And I like the connection between the Old Testament and the gospel this week. All right. That should do it. We do want to finish up by taking a moment to thanking our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Charlotte L., Balarian S., Michael H., Mark F., and Chuck C. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. If you have any feedback for us on our discussion, you can do so by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And of course, I'll have links from anything in our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com. Remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page. Retweet us on Twitter, where we're at SQPN. We are also on Instagram at StarQuest Network. And leave us comments wherever you find us online. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.